morning, her son had sat slumped over the kitchen table, his head in his hands, while her husband paced across the kitchen floor. Both her son's stillness and her husband's constant movement irritated her. She had barely woken up, hadn't even taken the rollers out of her hair. A pregnant girl before she drank her morning coffee. "You couldn't have found you a girl who didn't go to upper room?" she'd finally asked. "Mama, don't mama me. You know it's yours. Who knows how many of these boys she been with?" "It's mine," he said. "I know it." "A high school girl," she said. "Is she even 18? "Almost," he said softly. "After everything we taught you," John said. "After we raised you up in the word, after we told you about living in sin, you go out and do something as dumb as this?" She had witnessed this scene dozens of times before. Her husband yelling at Luke. For joyriding with his friends, theater hopping, sneaking beer onto the beach in old Coke bottles, smoking reefer in Buddy Todd Park, goading Marines into fights. He wasn't a bad kid, but he was reckless. Black boys couldn't afford to be reckless, she had tried to tell him. Reckless white boys became politicians and bankers. Reckless black boys became dead. How many times had she told Luke to be careful? But he'd messed around with a girl who was not even legal yet. What would Robert think? He would be angry, of course, but how angry? Angry enough to haul Luke to the police station? "She wants to get rid of it," Luke said. He looked defeated, brushing tears from the corner of his eye. She hadn't seen him cry in years. Her boy, like all boys, had long outgrown her mothering. She'd watched Luke's growth spurts, the stretch marks on his shoulders from summers of weightlifting, and the more mannish he became, the less he felt like her son. He was someone else now, a furtive and cagey person who disappeared behind closed doors and stopped talking on the phone when she entered the room. In elementary school, he'd wrestled with his friends on the living room rug, but in high school, she'd seen him shove a friend into a wall so hard, a picture fell off its hook. What bothered her most was the surprise on his face when she'd yelled at him to stop, as if roughness came so naturally, he was startled to find it a problem. A daughter grows older and draws nearer to her mother until she gradually overlaps her like a sewing pattern. But a son becomes some irreparably separate thing, so even though she hated to see her son cry, she was grateful for the chance to mother him again. She pulled him to her shoulder, stroking his hair. "Shh, now," she said. "Mama's taken care of it." At the bank, she withdrew $600 and slid the cash in an envelope for Luke to give to the girl. John hadn't slept that night, tossing in bed, then pacing across the bedroom floor.
"We shouldn't have done this," he said. "My spirit man is grieved."
But Latrice refused to feel guilty about it. They hadn't forced the girl to do anything she didn't already want to do. A girl who didn't want a baby would find a way to not have one. The good thing to do, the Christian thing, would be to make it a little easier on her. Now the girl could go off to college and leave their lives. It wasn't a perfect solution, but thank God it wasn't the disaster it could have been. Still, John felt grieved, and when Robert Turner had arrived at church on Sunday, his wrecked truck already felt like a sign the beginning of a long judgment. So John had gone to Robert's house and offered the girl a pity job without even consulting Latrice first. Now the girl would be all under her this summer, only because John wanted to atone for undeserved grief. "I don't owe her a thing," she said. "I'm all paid up." Chapter 4. At Elise Turner's funeral, the whole church arrived early, spilling out of the pews. "We have known hard deaths before. Sammy Watkins, who'd been stabbed outside a bar, his body crumpled and wedged between two trash cans. Moses Brewer, who'd been found in Buddy Todd Park, bludgeoned to death. Kayla Dean, a 14-year-old shot by Mexican Bloods because she'd been wearing her boyfriend's bright blue jacket. For a week, her high school had erupted in brawls between blacks and Mexicans until police arrived in riot gear and sheriff's helicopters circled overhead. All the while, Upper Room remained a source of calm, Pastor Shepherd urging sense in a situation that made none. To be killed over a jacket. A child waiting for fish tacos outside Alberto's who'd borrowed a jacket because she was cold, because her mother had fussed at her for coming home without one and tempting sickness. At Kayla Dean's funeral, Upper Room had encircled the wailing mother and held her up soundlessly, because hard deaths resist words. A soft death can be swallowed with "called home to be with the Lord," or "we'll see her again in glory." But hard deaths get caught in the teeth like gristle. We have known hard deaths, but the difference was that Elise Turner had chosen one. Not a handful of pills to stretch sleep, not a running motor in a closed garage, but a pistol to the head. How could she choose to destroy herself so violently? We'd all squeezed into pews, not knowing what to expect. What would the pastor say? Not the usual funeral scriptures. Those would not do. We wouldn't see her again in glory, because what glory awaited a woman who'd sent a bullet into her own head? She had not been called home to be with the Lord. She had simply chosen to leave. Imagine having the gall to choose when so many had that choice taken away from them. How dare she opt for a hard death when the rest of us were trying to manage the hard lives we'd been given? We have never understood it. Although maybe we should. We are, after all, the last ones to have seen Elise Turner alive. The morning she killed herself, we'd gone to Upper Room early to get started on our praying. At first, when we'd peeked through the sanctuary doors, we only saw a person wrapped in a down coat, slumped forward in front of the altar in what looked like prayer or sleep. A bum, probably. We stumbled across them sometimes in the mornings, sleeping across the pews. "All right now," Betty said. "You got to go. We won't tell nobody we seen you, but you got to go on now." No response. Probably a drunk bum. Lord, now those we couldn't deal with. Passed out drunk after mistaking the offering basket for a toilet, leaving broken beer bottles around for the babies to cut their feet. "Okay," Hattie said. "Now why don't you hop on up? We don't want to have to call the police." We edged closer, noticing for the first time, past the fur collar, long dark hair swept up away from a slender yellow neck. A neck that looked too clean for a bum's, too delicate for a man's. Agnes touched the strange woman's back. Elise, what are you doing in here?
I came in here last night and...
Elise looked dazed as Flora helped pull her to her feet.
Girl, it's morning already,
Agnes said. You better get on home to your child.
My child? Yes, honey. What you doing sleeping in here all night?
Robert probably worried sick, Hattie said. Get on home then. Go on.
At the time, we'd laughed as we watched Elise head through the morning fog to her car. Oh, wait till we told the ladies at Bingo about this. Elise Turner asleep in the church like an ordinary bum. They would have a field day with that one. She had always seemed a little strange to us anyway. Dreamy, like her mind was a balloon on a long string and she forgot to reel it in sometimes. For years, we've fixated on that final conversation. Elise had hesitated before going out to her car, a pause that varies in length throughout our memories. Betty says it was a long moment, Flora a brief hitch. Should we have known Elise would drive off and shoot herself? Was there any way of knowing? No. Nobody could have predicted it, not if Robert hadn't even known. Elise Turner was beautiful. She had a child and a husband with a good government job. She had gone from cleaning white folks' toilets to styling hair at the salon on base. A pretty black woman living as fine as any white woman. What did she have to complain about? That summer, Nadia Turner haunted us. She looked so much like her mother that folks around Upper Room started to feel like they'd seen Elise again, as if her restless spirit, and no one doubted it was restless, was roaming the place where it had last been seen. The girl, who haunted the church halls with her beauty and her sullenness, barely noticed the stairs until one evening when Second John offered her a ride home from work in the church van. He pulled onto the street, and for a second, their eyes met in the rearview mirror.
You look so much like your mama, he said. Gives me chills to look at you.
He glanced away, bashful almost, like he'd said the wrong thing. At dinner that night, she mentioned his comment to her father, and he glanced up, as if he'd needed to remind himself of what her face looked like.
You do,
he finally said, cutting his meat, his jaw set the way it always did whenever she tried to bring up her mother. Maybe that was why he always ran off to Upper Room, why he couldn't stand to be around her. Maybe he hated looking at her because she only reminded him of all that he'd lost. The night before her mother died, Nadia had caught her staring out the kitchen window, arms deep in soap suds, so gone in her own mind that she hadn't noticed the sink almost overflowing. She'd laughed a little when Nadia shut off the water.
Look at me, she'd said, off daydreaming again.
What had she been thinking about in that moment? Weren't your final hours supposed to be dramatic and meaningful? Shouldn't their last conversation have been emotional, even if it hadn't registered to her at the time? But there was nothing special about that last moment. She had laughed too and brushed past her mother to the refrigerator. The next morning, she'd woken to find her father sitting on the edge of her bed, his face in his hands, so quiet she hadn't even felt him sit on her mattress, weightless in his grief. She still searched for clues, for strange things her mother had done or said, for signs that she should have noticed. At least then, her mother's death would make sense. but she couldn't think of any hints that her mother had wanted to die. Maybe she'd never really known her mother at all. And if you couldn't know the person whose body was your first home, then who could you ever know? She was lonely. How could she be anything else? Each morning, her father dropped her off at Upper Room, and each afternoon, she sat on the church steps, waiting for him to pick her up. After work, she passed the hours in bed, watching old episodes of Law and Order, waiting for the next morning when she would awake and start her routine all over again. Sometimes she thought she could pass time like this, one day falling into another until autumn. The hot winds would arrive and she would blow out with them onto a new school in a new state where she would start a new life. Other times she felt so miserable, she thought about calling her old friends. But what would she say to them? She'd had a mother, and now she didn't. And she'd been pregnant, but now she wasn't. She'd thought with time the distance between her and her friends would narrow. But that gap had only widened, and she couldn't find the energy to pretend otherwise. So she remained alone, working silently in the first lady's office all morning, then shuffling outside at noon to eat lunch on the church steps. One afternoon, she was picking at her peanut butter sandwich when she noticed Aubrey Evans heading toward her. The girl smiled, clutching a sky blue lunch bag that matched her sundress. Nadia should have known she couldn't just bring a brown bag like everyone else.
"Can I sit here?" she asked.
Nadia shrugged. She didn't want to invite the girl to join her, but she couldn't very well tell her not to. Aubrey squinted into the sunlight and lowered herself onto the step. Then she unzipped her bag and pulled out tiny plastic containers, carefully arranging them on the step beside her. Nadia stared at tubs filled with macaroni and cheese, slices of steak, potato salad.
"That's seriously your lunch?" she said.
Of course it was. Of course Aubrey Evans' parents cooked her elaborate feasts for her lunch, because God forbid she should have to eat something as normal as a sandwich. Aubrey shrugged.
"Want some?"
Nadia hesitated before reaching for the brownie and breaking off a corner. She chewed slowly, almost disappointed by how delicious it was.
"Wow," she said. "Your mom made this?"
Aubrey carefully zipped up her lunch bag.
"I don't live with my mom," she said.
"So your dad then?"
"No," she said. "I live with my sister Mo and Casey."
"Who's Casey?"
"Mo's girlfriend. She's a really good cook."
"Your sister's gay?"
"So?" Aubrey said. "It's really not a big deal."
But she'd gotten prickly, so Nadia knew that it was. She still remembered how years ago the congregation had been convinced that Sister Janice's daughter had been turned into a lesbian because she'd started playing rugby at the junior college. For weeks, the old folks had whispered about how no girl should be playing football. It just wasn't right. Until she showed up on Easter Sunday holding hands with a shy boy, and that was that. At Upper Room, a gay sister was a big deal, and she wondered how she'd never heard about Aubrey's. Maybe because Aubrey didn't want anybody to know. Nadia couldn't help it. She was surprised. The life she'd imagined for Aubrey, a stay-at-home mother, a doting father, was melting away into something murkier. Why did Aubrey live with her sister, not her parents? Had something terrible happened to them? She felt a sudden kinship with a girl who didn't live with her mother either, a girl who was also a keeper of secrets. Aubrey tilted the brownie toward her, and Nadia silently broke off another piece. This is what she knew about Aubrey Evans. She'd appeared one Sunday morning, a strange girl wandering into Upper Room with nothing but a small handbag, not even a Bible. She'd started crying before the pastor asked who needed prayer, and she'd cried even harder as she rose and walked to the altar. She was saved at 16, and since then, she'd attended church services each week and volunteered for the children's ministry, the homeless ministry, the bereavement committee. Babies, bums, grief. A hint about where she'd come from, maybe, although Nadia only knew what most people did, that Aubrey had arrived at Upper Room suddenly, and within a year, she'd seemed like she'd always belonged. Now, each afternoon, the girls ate lunch together on the church steps. Each afternoon, Nadia learned more about Aubrey, like how she'd first visited Upper Room because she'd seen it on television. She was new to California then and camped out in front of the TV watching the wildfire coverage. She had never heard of wildfire season, and she had lived all over, so she thought she'd heard of everything. She'd spent 2 damp years in Portland, where she wrung rain out of her socks, then 3 years freezing in Milwaukee, another muggy year in Tallahassee. She'd dried out in Phoenix, then refrosted in Boston. She felt like she'd been everywhere and nowhere at all, like she had flown to thousands of airports, but never ventured outside of the terminal. "Why'd you move so much?" Nadia asked. "Was it like a military thing?" She had lived in Oceanside her whole life, unlike all the military kids from school who had followed a parent from Marine base to Marine base until they'd ended up at Camp Pendleton. She had never lived outside of California, never gone on exciting vacations, never left the country. Her life already seemed so singular and flat and dull, and she could only comfort herself with the fact that the good stuff was ahead. "No," Aubrey said. "My mom would just meet a man, and he'd move somewhere, so we'd go too." She had accompanied her mother as she followed boyfriends from state to state. A mechanic she'd loved in Cincinnati, a grocery store manager in Jackson, a truck driver in Dallas. She had never married, although she'd wanted to. In Denver, she'd dated a cop named Paul for 3 years. One Christmas, he gave her a small velvet box and her hands shook while opening it. It was just a bracelet, and even though she cried later in the bathroom, she still wore it around her wrist. Aubrey never mentioned her father. She told one or two stories about her mother, but only stories that had happened years ago, and Nadia began to wonder if her mother was even still alive. "Did she? I mean, your mom isn't..." But Nadia stopped herself before she could finish. She barely knew this girl. She couldn't ask if her mother was dead, too. But Aubrey understood and quickly shook her head. "No, no, nothing like that," she said. We don't get along, that's all." "Could you do that? Leave your mother because you two fought sometimes? Who didn't fight with her mother?" But Aubrey said nothing more, and her reticence only made Nadia even more intrigued. She imagined the lovesick mother chasing men from state to state, how when each affair ended, the mother would have cursed and cried, flinging clothes into a suitcase. How Aubrey and her sister must have known that when love left, they would have to leave too. "What were you like?" Nadia asked once, as a little kid. She was sitting in the passenger's seat of Aubrey's Jeep, her bare feet warming on the dashboard. They were stuck in the perpetually long drive-through line at In-N-Out, behind a brown minivan full of jostling kids. Earlier, Aubrey had suggested they go somewhere for lunch, Del Taco or Carl's Jr., or even Fat Charlie's. Luke Shepherd worked there, and maybe he'd recognize them from church and offer a discount. But Nadia had shaken her head and said that she hated seafood.
What was I like?
Aubrey smiled, her fingers dancing on the steering wheel. She always did that, repeated the question, like she was stumped in a job interview and needed to buy time.
Yeah, you know, as a little kid.
I was a brat. No one could tell me shit. Surprise, right? She laughed. Then Aubrey laughed. Another one of her habits, waiting for someone else to laugh before she joined in.
I played soccer. I had a lot of friends.
Aubrey shrugged.
My best friend had this trampoline. We'd jump on it for hours.
My mom told me not to. She said I'd break my neck. So I always lied to her.
What a badass.
One time, Aubrey said, we were super hungry, so we brought out this leftover cornbread to eat. It was really crumbly, though, but we kept jumping and eating, and all the crumbs were flying up with us, and we couldn't stop laughing. She smiled, like she was still proud of this tiny childhood rebellion, but the smile didn't reach her eyes. Another thing she did all the time, smile when she didn't mean it. When the fire season began, Aubrey had been living in California for 3 months. She had not known that wildfires could be a normal part of the calendar year, an event you expected as regularly as snow or rain, and the idea terrified her. Her sister told her that she shouldn't worry about wildfires, not in Oceanside at least. Along the coast, you were as safe as anyone could be. But she still followed the local news as reporters coughed in fields where flames licked behind them and helicopters swept over scorched ground, and that was how she first saw Upper Room. The church was serving as a temporary evacuation site, and a reporter interviewed the pastor, a large, dark man named John Shepherd.
"We're just glad to help," he said.
He had a deep, sonorous voice, like the type of man who might narrate a book on tape.
"We're grateful God has placed us in a position where we can give back to our community. So if you've been forced out your home, come to Upper Room and let us be a home to you."
Later, she told Nadia she realized that the pastor's plea had drawn her in. She was between homes then. She had been between homes her whole life, and she still felt like a guest in Mo and Casey's house. Each time she did her laundry, she folded her clothes and returned them to her suitcase, afraid to fill the drawers. But no one made her leave Oceanside, so she'd visited Upper Room one Sunday, and that was that. That year had been the worst fire season Nadia could remember. The local news ran flashy graphics calling October the fire siege. And even after the peak months had passed, 15 wildfires burned throughout Southern California that winter. If you had to evacuate, the sheriff's office left an automatic phone call, but her mother had always said that if you waited for the call, it was already too late. A sheriff's call only gave you a 15-minute warning, so last fall, her mother had packed bags in advance and left them by the front door.
"You think this is silly?" she told Nadia, "but you always got to be prepared, even for things you can't see."
She had grown up in Texas,
in between tornado and hurricane country, so she knew how to prepare for disaster. Unlike you California girls, she used to tell Nadia, who never thought about earthquakes until the world started shaking right under them. That winter, her mother's death would be an earthquake jolting her out of her sleep. But earlier in September, Nadia had watched her mother pack bags of clothes, water jugs, and photo albums. Then they'd left for church, where a crying girl had appeared in a light blue dress that fit her too tightly around the middle, as if she had just put on weight. Her curly hair was tied back in a ponytail, and she wore white canvas sneakers scuffed at the toes. She dressed like someone who had never been to church before imagined she ought to dress. The girl was mourning, and months later, in her own grief, whenever Nadia saw Aubrey at school, she envied how easily the girl had shown her sadness, how completely the church embraced her. Was that all it took? Kneeling at the altar and asking for help? Or did you have to invite everyone in on your private sorrow to be saved? Later, in the dying evening light, the girls swung gently in the ratty old hammock hanging in Nadia's backyard. Her father never used his hammock anymore. She couldn't remember the last time she'd seen him relaxed enough to enjoy it. But Aubrey had wanted to lie in it as soon as she followed Nadia outside.
"It feels like such a California thing to do," she'd said.
So every evening that week, they'd swung in the hammock and talked as the sun lowered in the sky. Nadia glanced at her father through the screen door. He'd cooked them dinner each night that week and hadn't complained about fixing Aubrey an extra plate. He seemed pleased to do it, almost. He smiled and tried to tell jokes about his day on base that would have been swallowed with mouthfuls of food had he and his daughter been alone. Maybe he was glad to have company again. Or maybe there was something special about Aubrey that made him open up. Across from her, Aubrey licked a dab of ice cream off her thumb and asked Nadia what her father was like.
"What do you mean?" Nadia said. "You know what he's like. You see him around. As a person, he's nice, but he doesn't talk much."
"I guess he's nice. I don't know. Serious, likes to be by himself."
"Why? What's your dad like?"
"I don't know. He left when I was little."
"Fine. Your mom, then."
Aubrey chewed on her thumbnail.
"We haven't talked in a while."
"How long is a while?"
"Almost a year."
Nadia had since grown used to the ebb and flow of their conversations, the opening up and shutting down, the ease forward, the retreat. So she just nodded and pretended to understand the way she would pretend all her life when friends complained about their mothers, rolling her eyes along with them while they ranted about mothers who disapproved of their jobs or their boyfriends, always sympathizing, always smiling, even though she hated them for complaining. She understood Aubrey even less. What did it feel like, she wondered, to be the one who'd left? If you drove east from the beach, if you left behind the surf shacks and bait shops and ice cream parlors, the lean surfers, the rent-a-cops cruising along the harbor, you'd reach the back gate. The entry to Camp Pendleton was guarded by armed Marines, but outside its border was a not-bad, not-good neighborhood. Here's how you could tell. The fences were higher, but the houses wore no metal gates over their windows. The Pizza Hut hid behind bulletproof glass, but they stayed open late at night. And cops still patrolled, more than they did in good neighborhoods, but more than they did in bad neighborhoods already abandoned to their own chaos.
In this not bad, not good neighborhood, Aubrey lived with her sister and her sister's girlfriend in a little white house. The house itself was simple, but Aubrey's bedroom was surprisingly ornate. The walls were painted a dusty green with silver flowers, and white Christmas lights traced the ceiling. Silver curtains rippled in the windows, and swathes of lace draped over the bed like a wedding veil. Her first visit, Nadia had wandered through the room slowly, her arms behind her back, afraid to touch anything, as if she were in a museum. "I couldn't sleep when I first moved in," Aubrey said, pointing to a dream catcher that hung from the ceiling. "Casey thought this might help." Casey was slender and lean like an alley cat, and she had long, dirty blonde hair she liked to rumple in the middle of conversations, as if to prove how little she cared about how her hair looked. She was a bartender downtown at the Flying Bridge, and she liked telling stories about her regulars. A man who hated touching dry glass. A woman who was deathly afraid of pickles.
"You know, them big ones they give you with your sandwich? Scared shitless. Runs and screams if you bring one near her, even if it's still in a jar. Wild, huh?"
Casey had traveled west 8 years ago with her big brother, who was stationed at Camp Pendleton. She was lovesick over a straight girl and had fled to California to forget about her. On the long drive from Tennessee, she'd plucked the dream catcher off a shelf at a truck stop, wanting it for no other reason than the fact that she could want it. Now the dream catcher drifted inside a bedroom almost painful in its effort. Aubrey said that her sister helped her decorate the room after she'd moved in.
"Mo thought we needed to do something together," she said. "We hadn't seen each other in a few years."
"Why not?" Nadia said.
"She left for college."
"And she just never came back?" Aubrey shifted slowly, one foot to the other.
"Well, she didn't like Paul."
"What was wrong with him?"
"He hit my mom," she said.
"Oh." Nadia paused in front of the bookshelf.
"Did he hit you?"
"Sometimes." Nadia couldn't imagine a grown man hitting her. Even when she'd misbehaved as a child, her father had always carried her to her mother, who did the spanking, as if discipline were something to be dealt with between women.
"Well, what'd your mom say?"
she said.
"She's still with them,"
Aubrey shrugged, then hopped off the bed.
"Come on, let's go outside."
Nadia finally understood why Aubrey had left and why her mother had let her, why her sister had helped her create a bedroom out of a Disney movie, why Mrs. Shepherd cherished her. In a way, Nadia almost felt lucky. At least her mother had been sick. At least she'd only tried to hurt herself. At least her mother would have never let a man hit her child. Her mother was dead, but what could be worse than knowing that your mother was alive somewhere, but she wanted a man who hit her more than she wanted you? On the 4th of July, Nadia sat on Aubrey's porch watching the neighbors set up fireworks in the street. The city was hosting a fireworks show downtown at the pier, but it wasn't the 4th of July without illegal fireworks, Casey had said. She was appalled by the strictness of California fireworks law, so she cheered on the people who smuggled them over from Tijuana to set off in the neighborhood. What was the harm? It wasn't as if people were setting off bombs. She sipped her beer, wrapping an arm around Monique, who watched the neighbors in the street, and shook her head.
"Someone's gonna blow a hand off," she said. "I just know it."
She was not a mother, but she had a mother's gift of rushing to the worst possible outcome. She was a trauma nurse at Scripps Mercy Hospital,
so she encountered the worst possible outcome daily. But even if she hadn't been a nurse, she was the type to worry. When she came home from work, she always asked if they had eaten. She reminded Aubrey to take her vitamins and called after her to grab a jacket. It gets chilly downtown. Oh, don't look at me like that. You know you always get cold. A man in the middle of the street squawked as a car swerving around the display nearly hit him. Monique shook her head again.
You warm enough, babe? She said.
Aubrey was sitting under a blanket with Nadia. She rolled her eyes a little.
I'm not a baby, Mo, she said. You're my baby, her sister said.
Casey laughed, and Aubrey rolled her eyes again, but she didn't look upset, not really. It was the fake annoyed look you give to someone who could never actually bother you. Sometimes Nadia envied Aubrey, even though she felt guilty for considering the thought. Aubrey had lost her mother too, but she was loved by her sister and her sister's girlfriend and even the first lady, three women who cared for her only because they wanted to. Both girls had been abandoned in the sand, but only Aubrey had been found. Only Aubrey had been chosen. Monique and Casey's love for Aubrey hung in their eyes, and even though it wasn't meant for Nadia, she inched closer, holding her hands up to the warmth. In the street, the neighbors huddled around, giving directions in Spanglish. Teenage girls herded babies onto the grass, while old men in flannel shirts redirected traffic, and boys on skateboards looked out for cops. Reggaeton and rap blasted out windows, rattling through cars parked in driveways. Soon, fireworks would illuminate the pier, but Nadia wanted to be nowhere else but here, in a house where everyone was wanted, with a family where anyone could leave, but nobody ever did. A firecracker lit up the sky, and she jumped, delighted and a little surprised at the first spark. Latrice Shepherd had ghost eyes. One brown and one blue, which meant her granddaddy had told her that she could see heaven and earth at the same time. Her mother had gasped the first time she'd held her. Something must be wrong. The blue eye blinded, maybe, already filmy with disease. But the doctor had said it was too soon to tell.
Takes time for a baby's eyes to adjust to the world, he'd said. Just pay attention. If the eyes squint or cloud, there may be cause for concern.
So she'd spent the first years of her life with her mother's face always inches from hers, studying her eyes. Maybe that was why she'd always felt there was something wrong with them, even though she could see fine. The brown eye seemed ugly next to the blue. The blue next to the brown, and she learned that it was better to just be one thing, to distill yourself into something as simple as you could. She had already begun her unending growth spurt. By the second grade, she was the first to line up in the school picture, and at lunch, she ate alone on the playground, while the other girls double-dutched to a rhyme they'd made up about her.
Latrice the Beast, she'll make you her feast, got two odd eyes and two big feet.
The height she couldn't hide, but the odd eyes she tried to. She started wearing sunglasses whenever she could, in the grocery store, in her bedroom, even in the classroom, handing her teacher a fake note from her doctor describing her sensitivity to light. Later in life, she would consider her odd eyes a blessing. Not ghost eyes, but she had been gifted with a second sight nonetheless. She could look at a girl and tell if she'd been hit before. Forget bruises and scars. Hit women learned to hide or explain those away. No need for stories about running into doorknobs or tripping downstairs. All she needed to do was lock her odd eyes onto theirs, and she knew a woman surprised or outraged by pain from a woman who'd learned to expect it. She saw past flawless skin to diamond-shaped iron burns, gashes from golden belt buckles, necks nicked by steak knives, lips split by class rings, faces blooming purple and deep blue. She'd told Aubrey this the third time she'd invited her for tea, and after, Aubrey had stared into the mirror, wondering what else the first lady saw. Was her entire past written on her skin? Could Mrs. Shepherd see everything that Paul had done to her? At least now she knew why Mrs. Shepherd had been so kind to her. Why, after the altar call, Mrs. Shepherd had found her in the church lobby and offered her a hug. Why, the following Sunday, Mrs. Shepherd had given her a small Bible with a floral cover. And why, the Sunday after that, Mrs. Shepherd had invited her into her office for tea. Aubrey didn't even drink tea. But for months, she'd sat on the other side of the gray-striped settee, dropping sugar cubes into her cup. She took her tea sweet, sugar, honey, and cream. "That's fine in here," Mrs. Shepherd had told her once, "but out in public, folks might think it's juvenile, a young lady doctoring up her tea with all those sweets." She'd corrected Aubrey gently. But Aubrey had felt so embarrassed that weeks later, she'd only added a single sugar cube to her tea. One afternoon, she sipped the bitter tea and asked Mrs. Shepherd what had happened to Elise Turner. She lofted the question casually, as if she hadn't been wondering it for weeks, no, months, ever since Pastor Shepherd had somberly announced the news to the congregation. At the time, he hadn't offered a cause of death, which had raised suspicions the way only a sudden, unexplained death could. A woman Elise Turner's age didn't just die naturally. She hadn't seemed ill, and if she hadn't suffered some terrible accident, then what could have happened to her? "I just don't know," Sister Willis had said in the ladies' room after service. "Something just don't sound right to me." And even though the other women around the sink had nodded, no one had expected the news that trickled in days later that Elise Turner had shot herself in the head. The congregation had already imagined possible shameful tragedies. An accidental drug overdose, a drunk driving accident, even a murder caused by circumstances the pastor had thought it best to obscure. Maybe Elise had taken a lover. She could do better than Robert, couldn't she? And in the seedy motel room where they'd conducted their affair, the lover had killed her. Despite the lurid speculation, no one had been prepared for the reality of Elise Turner's death, especially not Aubrey. She had never known Mrs. Turner, but she'd felt as if she did, at least a little, the way you could know someone you'd only seen from a distance. On Sundays, she'd seen the Turners enter upper room, the husband stiff-backed in his suit, the wife smiling at the greeters in the lobby, the daughter a spitting image of the mother. They'd reminded her of a family out of television, the strong, manly father, the beautiful mother, and the daughter, who had somehow been blessed with beauty and smarts. In AP government, Aubrey sat near the back watching Nadia breeze into class with her friends, and whenever she slipped through the door after the bell rang, she appeased Mr. Thomas with a smile before he could write her up for detention. How could he punish her? Week after week, when he listed the top 10 test scorers, her name was on the whiteboard, as if it had been written in permanent marker. She was going to a big university someday. Everyone knew it. While Aubrey would shuffle off to the community college with the rest of their class. On Sunday mornings, she watched this girl, this Nadia Turner, slide into the church pew beside her mother and her father, and she wondered what it would be like to go to church with your family. Mo didn't believe in God. Casey did, only abstractly, the way she believed in the universe's ability to write itself. Neither was happy that Aubrey had started going to church, although they hadn't said so directly. "Are you sure you want to spend so much time there?" Mo would say. "I mean, don't you think it's maybe a little too soon?" Too soon for what? She'd never said, but she didn't have to. She worried that Aubrey had turned into some religious nut, that she would start seeing images of Jesus in burnt toast, or speaking in tongues mid-conversation, or picketing outside gay weddings. When Aubrey had seen the Turners on Sundays, she wondered what it would be like to be their child, to be smart and beautiful, to have a father and a mother who held your hands during prayer. She thought about the mother especially, who seemed nothing like her own. Elise Turner, young and energetic and beautiful, who laughed in the lobby before service, always greeted as soon as she stepped inside, who had spoken to Aubrey once before when they'd passed each other before the Christmas play.
"You dropped something, honey,"
Elise Turner had said, pointing at Aubrey's program, which had fluttered to the carpet. Her voice was cool and silky like milk. How could a woman like that kill herself? Aubrey knew it was a stupid question. Anyone could kill herself if she wanted to badly enough. Mo said that it was physiological. Misfired synapses, unbalanced chemicals in the brain, the whole body a machine with a few tripped wires that had caused it to self-destruct. But people weren't just their bodies, right? The decision to kill yourself had to be more complicated than that. Across the couch, the First Lady raised an eyebrow as she leaned forward to refill Aubrey's teacup.
"What do you mean?" Mrs. Shepherd said. "You know what happened to her."
"I just know she shot herself."
"Well, that's all there is to it, honey."
"But why?"
Aubrey said.
"The devil attacks all of us,"
Mrs. Shepherd said.
"Some folks just aren't strong enough to fend him off."
She sounded matter-of-fact as she slowly stirred her tea, the spoon clanging against the cup. She was also nothing like Aubrey's mother, too assertive and steady and sure of herself. Her mother was one of the weak women Mrs. Shepherd would pity or scorn, depending on how much she knew. Right now, she didn't know much, only that Aubrey had moved in with her sister because she and her mom hadn't gotten along. She hadn't told Mrs. Shepherd about Paul, who drank bottles of whiskey on weekends and sometimes hit them, but always cried about it after because he didn't mean to. His job was so stressful. They just didn't know what it was like being out on the streets all the time, not knowing if you'd make it home. He'd moved in a year before she'd left, and for a year, he had made nightly trips to her room, pushing her door open, then her legs. And for a year, she had told almost no one. Almost, because she'd told her mother after the first time it happened, and her mother had shook her head tightly and said, "No," as if she could will it to be untrue. Across the couch, Mrs. Shepherd reached for a cookie.
Now, why do you want to know about all this? She asked.
I don't know, Aubrey said. Nadia never talks about it.
She couldn't exactly ask Nadia herself, although she thought about it often when they were together. Did Nadia know why her mother had killed herself? Was it even better to know?
I see you two out there eating lunch all the time.
Mrs. Shepherd smiled, brushing sugar dust from her fingers onto a napkin.
I didn't know you got on like that.
She's nice.
Aubrey paused, taking a sip.
I don't know. Funny. She makes me laugh. And she doesn't let people run over her. She's not afraid of anything.
I just wouldn't get too attached if I was you,
Mrs. Shepherd said. Aubrey frowned.
Why?
Now, don't look at me like that. You know she's running off to school in the fall, making new friends in the dorms. Folks change, that's all. I just don't want you to get hurt, honey.
Mrs. Shepherd passed her the plate of shortbread cookies, and Aubrey silently took one. The first time she'd visited Nadia's house, she'd spotted on her bookshelf a clay Noah's Ark statue, small enough to fit in her palm. A white-haired Noah stood on the deck, tiny giraffe and chimp and elephant heads poking out the portholes. She'd reached for it, but Nadia had grabbed her hand.
Don't, she'd said. My mom gave me that.
Aubrey had drawn her hand back. Embarrassed for violating a rule she hadn't known existed. But she saw then that Nadia didn't speak about her mother because she wanted to preserve her, keep her for herself. Aubrey didn't speak about her mother because she wanted to forget that she'd ever had one. And it was easier to forget when she was with Nadia. She didn't want to think about Nadia leaving for college. She felt at home in Nadia's motherless world. Later that evening, she drove her friend home. They went out in the backyard and rocked in Mr. Turner's hammock until the sky faded into black. Nadia stretched a long leg over the side and pushed her bare toes against the grass, careful not to upset their delicate balance.
Chapter 5. We were girls once. As hard as that is to believe. Oh, you can't see it now. Our bodies have stretched and sagged, faces and necks drooping. That's what happens when you get old. Every part of you drops, as if the body is moving closer to where it's from and where it'll return. But we were girls once, which is to say, we have all loved an ancient man. No Christian way of putting it. There are two types of men in the world. Men who are and men who ain't about shit. As girls, we've lived all over. Sharecropping in the cotton fields of Louisiana until the humid air sucked our shirts to our backs. Shivering in freezing kitchens while packing lunches for daddies heading to Ford plants. Shuffling slowly over icy Harlem sidewalks, stuffing ripped fabric in coat pocket holes. Then we'd grown up and met men who wanted to bring us to California. Military men stationed out at Camp Pendleton, who promised us marriage and babies and all that sunshine. But before we woke to pink clouds drifting over the coastline, before we found upper room in each other, before we were wives and mothers, we were girls, and we loved ancient men. You used to be able to spot an ancient man a lot easier. At pool halls and juke joints, speakeasies and rent parties, and sometimes in church, snoring in the back pew. The type of man our brothers warned us about, because he was going nowhere and he would treat us bad on the way to that nowhere. But nowadays, most of these young men seem ain't shit to us. Swaggering around downtown, drunk and swearing, fighting outside nightclubs, smoking reefer in their mama's basements. When we were girls, a man who wanted to court us sipped coffee in the living room with our parents first. Nowadays, a young man fools around with any girl who's willing, and if she gets in trouble, well, you just ask Luke Shepherd what these young men do next. A girl nowadays has to get nice and close to tell if her man ain't shit, and by then, it might be too late. We were girls once. It's exciting, loving someone who can never love you back. Freeing in its own way. No shame in loving an ain't shit man, long as you get it out your system good and early. A tragic woman hooks into an ain't shit man, or worse, lets him hook into her. He will drag her until he tires. He will climb atop her shoulders and her body will sag from the weight of loving him. Yes, those are the ones we worry about. Since he'd seen Nadia Turner last, Luke had broken 7 plates, 2 bowls, and 6 glasses.
A personal record,
his boss Charlie had announced during the morning's staff meeting.
No. Scratch that. A company best. Give it up for Shepherd, folks. Making history one fuck up at a time.
Luke never dropped dishes. He'd spent years grabbing footballs out of the air, snagging them out of the reach of defenders, cupping his hands underneath them before they hit the grass. In fact, he was heralded throughout Fat Charlie's seafood shack for his miraculous catches. The highlight reel, if one existed, would have consisted entirely of Luke Shepherd. Luke grabbing sippy cups before they teetered to the floor. Luke palming bowls tipped by wayward elbows. Luke riding trays sliding off their stands as customers applauded and co-workers clapped him on the back. But since Cody Richardson's party, there'd been no heroics, no last-minute saves, no godlike displays of reflex and awareness. The commentators on SportsCenter, if SportsCenter covered workplace athleticism, would have hung their heads and said, "Too bad, that Shepherd kid sure had shown a lot of promise." Now glasses slipped right through his hand or slid off his tray, and Luke, who worshipped the save, the graceful leap into the end zone, found himself instead kneeling on the sticky floor, watery Sprite soaking his pant leg.
"Oh, for fuck's sake," Charlie said, hovering over him. "I know, I know. You trying to break every dish I own?"
"I said I'm sorry. What you want me to do? I'm cleaning it."
"I want you to learn how to hold a cup. A monkey can hold a cup, Shepherd, a fucking chimp."
Luke pushed past Charlie on his way to the trash can, and that slight shoulder tap, the inch of space he'd forced Charlie to yield, felt like that moment after the doctor injected pain medicine into his leg. A pinch, and then relief. Focus. That's what Luke needed to do. Concentrate on one thing at a time. The smooth motion of his arm when he reached for the cup, the way the glass felt against his palm as he tightened his grip. And he did focus, from time to time. He survived a shift without dropping anything. Then Nadia returned to him, a sharp, sudden pain like hunger. Kissing her in the beach shower, his hands, still gritty with sand, on her stomach,
His lips passed against the back of her suntanned neck. Later, kneeling at the edge of his bed, hooking his fingers under the sides of her bikini bottom, her skin smoldering under his hands. She smelled like the ocean. She felt like the ocean when he was inside of her, rocking and rocking and calm. When it was over, he'd kissed the side of her face, the soft skin near her ears, the light baby hair turned curly from their sweat. His mouth had never touched anything that delicate. He spent his dinner break smoking in the alley behind Fat Charlie's with CJ. They used to play high school football together. CJ, a burly Samoan with long curly hair, had been a decent nose tackle and earned a few letters from Division III schools, nothing like the recruitment packets and personal visits Luke had received. Still, they'd both ended up here, in an alley that smelled like wet garbage and sea air and cat piss. Luke leaned against the wall, passing the joint.
"You good, Uso?" CJ said. "You got a weird look on your face."